for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton.
What up, y'all?
This is Anti-War Radio.
Soundtrack, what's poppin', baby? Woo! Y'all ain't know, I go by the name of Lupe Fiasco, representing that first and 15. Yeah, and this one right here, I dedicate this one right here to all my homies out there grinding. You know what I'm saying? Legally and illegally. You know what I'm talking about? So, check it out. First got it when he was 6, didn't know any tricks. Matter of fact, first time he got on it, he slipped, landed on his hip and busted his lip. For a week he had to talk with a list like this. Now we can end the story right here, but shorty didn't quit, it was something in the air. Yeah, he said it was something so appealing, he couldn't fight the feeling, something about it. He knew he couldn't doubt it, couldn't understand it. Branded, since the first kickflip he landed, labeled a misfit, a bandit, cocoon, cocoon, cocoon. His neighbors couldn't stand it, so he was banished to the park. Started in the morning, one stopped after dark. Yeah, when they said it's getting late in here, so I'm sorry, young man, there's no skating here. And so we kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. And the way he rolled, just a rebel to the world with no place to go. And so we kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. So come escape with me, just a rebel looking for a place to be. So let's kick and push and coast. My man got a little older, became a better roller. Yeah, no helmet, hell bent on killing himself is what his mama said, but he was feeling himself. Got a little more swag in his style. Met his girlfriend, she was clapping in the crowd. Love is what was happening to him now. He said I would marry you, but I'm engaged to these Ariels and Varials, and I don't think this board is strong enough to carry two. She said, bow, I weigh 120 pounds. Now, let me make one thing clear, I don't need to ride yours, I got mine right here. So she took him to a spot he didn't know about, some odd in the apartment parking lot. She said, I don't normally take dates in here. Security came and said, I'm sorry, there's no skating here. And so they kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. And the way they roll, just lovers intertwined with no place to go. And so they kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. So come escape with me, just a rebel looking for a place to be. So let's kick and push, yeah, and coast.
Yeah, swanky.
Yeah, yeah, before he knew he had a crew that wasn't no punk, and they spit fire shirts and SB dunks. They would push till they couldn't skate no more. Office building lobbies wasn't safe no more, and it wasn't like they wasn't getting chased no more. Just the freedom was better than breathing, they said. An escape route they used to escape out. When things got crazy, they needed to break out. They had to any place with stairs, any good grinds, the world was theirs. And they four wheels would take them there, until the cops came and said, there's no skating here. And so they kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. And the way they roll, just rebels without a cause, with no place to go. And so they kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. So come roll with me, just a rebel looking for a place to be. So let's kick and push, yeah.
All right, y'all, thanks for tuning in. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, 92.7 FM. As well, streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com. Couple other websites real quick, antiwar.com, my blog, thestressblog.com, libertystickers.com, the Scott Horton section there especially. My MySpace page is myspace.com/Scott_Horton if you want to be my MySpace friend. And I'm pointing now to The Nation magazine. I tried to get a hold of the author, but I only had his old email address, so I'll see if I can get Chris Hedges on to discuss this either tomorrow or next week. If you're not familiar with Chris Hedges, he's the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And also, I believe, put together a book called What Every Soldier Should Know About War. it's answers to the frequently asked questions. The guy's covered wars all over the world, on every continent but North America, I guess, and even from here. But he covered the wars in Bosnia, in, I think, in Kashmir, the first Iraq war, the Falklands war, Chechnya. The guy's got a lot of experience, and he wrote a great book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I've interviewed him once before. You can find the archive at scotthortonshow.com. But anyway, this is Chris Hedges' new article for The Nation magazine, co-written with Lalia, Layla? I guess it's Layla Al-Aryan. Pardon me, ma'am, for getting your name wrong. From the July 30th issue of The Nation magazine. Over the past several months, The Nation has interviewed 50 combat veterans of the Iraq War from around the United States in an effort to investigate the effects of the four-year-old occupation on average Iraqi civilians. These combat veterans, some of whom bear deep emotional and physical scars, and many of whom who have come to oppose the occupation, gave vivid on-the-record accounts. They describe a brutal side of the war rarely seen on television screens or chronicled in newspaper accounts. Their stories, recorded and typed into thousands of pages of transcripts, reveal disturbing patterns of behavior by American troops in Iraq. Dozens of those interviewed witnessed Iraqi civilians, including children, dying from American firepower. Some participated in such killings, others treated or investigated civilian casualties after the fact. Many also heard such stories in detail from members of their unit. The soldiers, sailors, and Marines emphasized that not all troops took part in indiscriminate killings. Many said that these acts were perpetrated by a minority, but they nevertheless described such acts as common, and said they often go unreported and almost always go unpunished. Court cases, such as the ones surrounding the massacre in Haditha and the rape and murder of a 14-year-old in Mahmoudia, and news stories in the Washington Post, Time, the London Independent, and elsewhere, based on Iraqi accounts, have begun to hint at the wide extent of the attacks on civilians. Human rights groups have issued reports, such as Human Rights Watch's Hearts and Minds, post-war civilian deaths in Baghdad caused by U.S. forces, packed with detailed incidents that suggest that the killing of Iraqi civilians by occupation forces is more common than has been acknowledged by military authorities. This Nation investigation marks the first time so many on-the-record named eyewitnesses from within the U.S. military have been assembled in one place to openly corroborate these assertions. While some veterans said civilian shootings were routinely investigated by the military, many more said such inquiries were rare. Quote, I mean, you physically could not do an investigation every time a civilian was wounded or killed because it just happens a lot and you'd spend all your time doing that, said Marine Reserve Lieutenant Jonathan Morgenstein, 35, of Arlington, Virginia. He served from August 2004 to March 2005 in Ramadi with a Marine Corps Civil Affairs Unit supporting a combat team with the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Brigade. All interviewees are identified by the rank they held during the period of service they recount here. Some have since been promoted or demoted. Veterans said the culture of this counterinsurgency war, in which most Iraqi civilians were assumed to be hostile, made it difficult for soldiers to sympathize with their victims, at least until they returned home and had a chance to reflect. I guess while I was there, the general attitude was, a dead Iraqi is just another dead Iraqi, said Specialist Jeff Engelhart, 26, of Grand Junction, Colorado. Specialist Engelhart served with the 3rd Brigade, 1st Infantry Division in Bakuba, about 35 miles northeast of Baghdad, for a year beginning in February 2004. You know, so what? The soldiers honestly thought we were trying to help the people, and they were mad because it was almost like a betrayal. Like, here we are trying to help you. Here I am, you know, thousands of miles away from my home and my family, and I have to be here for a year and work every day on these missions. Well, we're trying to help you. And you just turn around and try to kill us. He said it was only, quote, when they get home and dealing with veterans' issues and meeting other veterans, it seems like the guilt really takes place, takes root then. The Iraq War is a vast and complicated enterprise. In this investigation of alleged military misconduct, The Nation focused on a few key elements of the occupation, asking veterans to explain in detail their experiences operating patrols and supply convoys, setting up checkpoints, conducting raids, and arresting suspects. From these collected snapshots, a common theme emerged. Fighting in densely populated urban areas has led to the indiscriminate use of force and the deaths at the hands of occupation troops of thousands of innocents. Many of these veterans returned home deeply disturbed by the disparity between the reality of the war and the way it is portrayed by the U.S. government and American media. The war the vets describe as a dark and even depraved enterprise, one that bears a powerful resemblance to other misguided and brutal colonial wars and occupations, from the French occupation of Algeria to the American war in Vietnam and the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory. "I'll tell you the point where I really turned," said Specialist Michael Harmon, 24, a medic from Brooklyn. He served a 13-month tour beginning in April 2003 with 167th Armor Regiment, 4th Infantry Division, in Al-Rashidiya, a small town near Baghdad. "I go out to the scene, and there was this little, you know, pudgy little 2-year-old child with the cute little pudgy legs. And I look, and she has a bullet through her leg. An IED went off, the gun-happy soldiers just started shooting anywhere, and the baby got hit. And this baby looked at me, wasn't crying, wasn't anything. It just looked at me. I know she couldn't speak. It might sound crazy, but she was like asking me why, you know, why do I have a bullet in my leg? It was just like, this is it, this is it, this is ridiculous." Much of the resentment toward Iraqis described to The Nation by veterans was confirmed in a report released May 4th by the Pentagon. According to the survey conducted by the Office of the Surgeon General of the U.S. Army Medical Command, just 47% of soldiers and 38% of Marines agreed that civilians should be treated with dignity and respect. Only 55% of soldiers and 40% of Marines said they would report a unit member who had killed or injured, quote, an innocent non-combatant. These attitudes reflect the limited contact occupation troops said they had with Iraqis. They rarely saw their enemy. They lived bottled up in heavily fortified compounds that often come under mortar attack. They only ventured outside their compounds ready for combat. The mounting frustration of fighting an elusive enemy and the devastating effect of roadside bombs with their steady toll of American dead and wounded led many troops to declare an open war on all Iraqis. Veterans described reckless firing once they left their compounds. Some shot holes into cans of gasoline being sold along the roadside and then tossed grenades into the pool of gas to set them ablaze. Others opened fire on children. These shootings often enraged Iraqi witnesses. In June 2003, Staff Sergeant Camilio Mejia's unit was pressed by a furious crowd in Ramadi. Sergeant Mejia, 31, a National Guardsman from Miami, served for 6 months beginning in April 2003 with the 1-124 Infantry Battalion, 53rd Infantry Brigade. His squad opened fire on an Iraqi youth holding a grenade, riddling his body with bullets. Sergeant Mejia checked his clip afterwards and calculated that he had personally fired 11 rounds into the young man. Quote, "The frustration that resulted from our inability to get back at those who were attacking us led to tactics that seemed designed to simply punish the local population that was supporting them," Sergeant Mejia said. "We heard a few reports, in one case corroborated by photographs, that some soldiers had so lost their moral compass that they'd mocked or desecrated Iraqi corpses. One photo, among dozens turned over to The Nation during the investigation, shows an American soldier acting as if he is about to eat the spilled brains of a dead Iraqi man with his brown plastic Army-issue spoon. 'Take a picture of me and this motherfucker,' a soldier who had been in Sergeant Mejia's squad said as he put his arm around the corpse. Sergeant Mejia recalls that the shroud covering the body fell away, revealing that the young man was wearing only his pants. There was a bullet hole in his chest. 'Damn, they really fucked you up, didn't they?' the soldier laughed. The scene, Sergeant Mejia said, was witnessed by the dead man's brothers and cousins. In the section that follows, snipers, medics, military police, artillerymen, officers, and others recount their experiences serving in places as diverse as Mosul in the north, Samarra in the Sunni triangle, Nasiriyah in the south, and Baghdad in the center during 2003, 2004, and 2005. Their stories capture the impact of their units on Iraqi civilians. Again, if you're just tuning in, this is The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness, by Chris Hedges, and I'm going to have to scroll up to the top to tell you the other person's name. Sorry. Lila Al-Aryan in The Nation magazine. Chris Hedges and Lila Al-Aryan, The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness. It's at thenation.com. A note on methodology. The Nation interviewed 50 combat veterans, including 40 soldiers, 8 Marines, and 2 sailors, over a period of 7 months beginning in July 2006. To find veterans willing to speak on the record about their experiences in Iraq, we sent queries to organizations dedicated to U.S. troops and their families, including Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, the anti-war groups Military Families Speak Out, Veterans for Peace, and Iraq Veterans Against the War, and the pro-war group Vets for Freedom. The leaders of IVAW and Paul Rykoff, the founder of IAVA, were especially helpful in putting us in touch with Iraq War veterans. Finally, we found veterans through word of mouth, as many of those we interviewed referred us to their military friends. To verify their military service, when possible, we obtained a copy of each interviewee's DD Form 214, or the Certificate of release or discharge from active duty, and in all cases confirmed their service with the branch of the military in which they were enlisted. 19 interviews were conducted in person while the rest were done over the phone. All were tape recorded and transcribed. All but 5 interviewees, most of those currently on active duty, were independently contacted by fact checkers to confirm basic facts about their service in Iraq. Of those interviewed, 14 served in Iraq from 2003 to 2004, 20 from 2004 to 2005, and 2 from 2005 to 2006. Of the 11 veterans whose tours lasted less than 1 year, 9 served in 2003, while the others served in 2004 and 2005. The ranks of the veterans we interviewed ranged from private to captain, though only a handful were officers. The veterans served throughout Iraq, but mostly in the country's most volatile areas, such as Baghdad, Tikrit, Mosul, Fallujah, and Samarra. During the course of the interview process, 5 veterans turned over photographs from Iraq, some of them graphic, to corroborate their claims. Raids. This is, again, Chris Hedges in The Nation magazine. Quote, so we get started on this day, this one in particular, recalled Specialist Philip Crystal, 23, of Reno, Nevada, who said he raided between 20 and 30 Iraqi homes during an 11-month tour in Kirkuk and Hawija that ended in October 2005, serving with the 3rd Battalion, 116th Cavalry Brigade. Quote, it starts with the PSYOPs vehicles out there, you know, with the big speakers playing a message in Arabic or Farsi or Kurdish or whatever they happen to be, saying basically, put your weapons, if you have them, next to the front door in your house. Please come outside, blah, blah, blah. And we had Apaches flying over for security if they're needed. And it's also a good show of force. And we're running around, and we've done a few houses by this point. I was with my platoon leader, my squad leader, and maybe a couple of other people. And we were approaching this one house, he said, in this farming area. They're like built up into little courtyards. So they have the main house, a common area. They have a kitchen, and then they have a storage-type shed deal. And we're approaching, and they had a family dog. And it was barking ferociously because it's doing its job. And my squad leader, just out of nowhere, just shoots it. And he didn't, motherfucker. He shot it, and it went in the jaw and exited out. So I see this dog. I'm a huge animal lover. I love animals. And this dog has, like, these eyes on it. And he's running around spraying blood all over the place. And you know what the hell is going on? The family is sitting right there with 3 little children and a mom and a dad. They're horrified. And I'm at a loss for words. And so I yell at him, what the fuck are you doing? And so the dog's yelping. It's crying out without a jaw. And I'm looking at the family and they're just, you know, dead scared. And so I told them, I said, fucking shoot it. You know, at least kill it because that can't be fixed. And continuing the quote, I actually get tears from saying this right now. But I had tears then, too. And I'm looking at the kids, and they are so scared. So I got the interpreter over with me, you know, and I get my wallet out, and I gave them $20, because that's what I had. And, you know, I had him give it to them and told them that I'm so sorry that asshole did that. Was a report ever filed about it? Was anything ever done? Any punishment ever dished out? No, absolutely not. End quote. Specialist Crystal said such incidents were very common. According to interviews with 24 veterans who participated in such raids, they are a relentless reality for Iraqis under occupation. The American forces, stymied by poor intelligence, invade neighborhoods where insurgents operate, bursting into homes in the hope of surprising fighters or finding weapons. But such catches, they said, are rare. Far more common were stories in which soldiers assaulted a home, destroyed property in their futile search, and left terrorized civilians struggling to repair the damage and begin the long torment of trying to find family members who were hauled away as suspects. Raids normally took place between midnight and 5 a.m., according to Sergeant John Brune, 29, of Philadelphia, who estimates that he took part in raids of nearly 1,000 Iraqi homes. He served in Baghdad and Abu Ghraib, a city infamous for its prison, located 20 miles west of the capital with the 3rd Brigade, 1st Armored Division, 1st Battalion, for 1 year, beginning in April 2003. His descriptions of raid procedures closely echo those of 8 other veterans, who served in locations as diverse as Kirkuk, Samarra, Baghdad, Mosul, and Tikrit. You want to catch them off guard, Sergeant Burns explains. You want to catch them in their sleep. About 10 troops were involved in each raid, he said, with 5 stationed outside and the rest searching the home. Once they were in front of the home, troops, some wearing Kevlar helmets and flak vests with grenade launchers mounted on their weapons, kicked in the door, according to Sergeant Burns, who dispassionately described the procedure. You run in. If there's lights, you turn them on. If the lights are working. If not, you've got flashlights. You leave one rifle team outside while one rifle team goes inside. Each rifle team leader has a headset on with an earpiece and a microphone where he can communicate with the other rifle team's leader that's outside. You go up the stairs. You grab the man of the house. You rip him out of bed in front of his wife. You put him up against the wall. You have junior-level troops, PFCs, that's privates, first class, specialists, will run into the other rooms and grab the family, and you'll group them all together. Then you go into a room, and you tear the room to shreds, and you make sure there's no weapons or anything that they can use to attack us. You get the interpreter, and you get the man of the house, and you have him at gunpoint, and you'll ask the interpreter to ask him, do you have any weapons? Do you have any anti-U.S. propaganda? Anything at all, anything in here that would lead us to believe that you are somehow involved in insurgent activity or anti-coalition forces activity? Normally, they'll say no, because normally, that's the truth, Sergeant Brune said. So what you'll do is you'll take his sofa cushions, you'll dump them. If he has a couch, you'll turn the couch upside down. You'll go to the fridge if he has a fridge and you'll throw everything on the floor. And you'll take his drawers and you'll dump them. You'll open up his closet and you'll throw all the clothes on the floor and basically leave his house looking like a hurricane just hit it. Yeah, it sounds like having a cop serve a warrant in the United States of America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. Sorry, that's my little editorial. Continuing with this Nation article by Christopher Hedges, interviews with dozens of soldiers. And if you find something, then you'll detain him. If not, you'll say, sorry to disturb you, have a nice evening. So you've just humiliated this man in front of his entire family and terrorized his entire family, and you've destroyed his home. And then you go right next door and you do the same thing in 100 homes. Each raid, or cordon and search operation, as they are sometimes called, involved 5 to 20 homes, he said. Following a spate of attacks on soldiers in a particular area, commanders would normally order infantrymen on raids to look for weapons, caches, ammunition, or materials for making IEDs. Each Iraqi family was allowed to keep one AK-47 at home, but according to Bruins, those found with extra weapons were arrested and detained, and the operation classified a, quote, success, even if it was clear that no one in the home was an insurgent. Before a raid, according to descriptions by several veterans, soldiers typically quarantined the area by barring anyone from coming in or leaving. In pre-raid briefings, Sergeant Brune said, military commanders often told their troops the neighborhood they were ordered to raid was a hostile area with a high level of insurgency, and that it had been taken over by former Baathists or Al-Qaeda terrorists. Quote, so you have all these troops and they're all wound up, said Sergeant Brunes. And a lot of these troops think once they kick down the door, there's going to be people on the inside waiting for them with weapons to start shooting at them. Sergeant Dustin Flatt, 33, of Denver, estimates he raided thousands of homes in Tikrit, Samarra, and Mosul. He served with the 18th Infantry Brigade, 1st Infantry Division, for 1 year beginning in February 2004. We scared the living Jesus out of them every time we went through every house, he said. Specialist Ali Aoun, 23, a National Guardsman from New York City, said he conducted perimeter security in nearly 100 raids while serving in Sadr City with the 89th Military Police Brigade for 11 months, starting in April 2004. When soldiers raided a home, he said, they first cordoned it off with Humvees. Soldiers guarded the entrance to make sure no one escaped. If an entire town was being raided in large-scale operations, it too was cordoned off, said Specialist Garrett Reppenhagen, 32, of Manitou Springs, Colorado, a cavalry scout and sniper with the 263rd Armored Battalion, 1st Infantry Division, who was deployed to Bakuba for a year in February 2004. Staff Sergeant Timothy John Westfall, 31, of Denver, recalled one summer night in 2004, the temperature an oppressive 110 degrees, when he and 44 other U.S. soldiers raided a sprawling farm on the outskirts of Tikrit. Sergeant Westfall, who served there for a year-long tour with the 18th Infantry Brigade, 1st Infantry Division, beginning in February 2004, said he was told some men on the farm were insurgents. As a mechanized infantry squad leader, Sergeant Westfall led the mission to secure the main house, while 15 men swept the property. Sergeant Westfall and his men hopped the wall surrounding the house, fully expecting to come face-to-face with armed insurgents. We had our flashlights, and I told my guys, on the count of three, just hit them with your lights and let's see what we've got here. Wake them up. Sergeant Westfall's flashlight was mounted on his M4 carbine rifle, a smaller version of the M16. So in pointing his light at the clump of sleepers on the floor, he was also pointing his weapon at them. Sergeant Westfall first turned his light on a man who appeared to be in his mid-60s. Quote, "The man screamed this gut-wrenching, blood-curdling, just horrified scream," Sergeant Westfall recalled. "I never heard anything like that. I mean, the guy was absolutely terrified." I can imagine what he was thinking, having lived under Saddam. Yeah, that's probably what he was scared of. The farm's inhabitants were not insurgents, but a family sleeping outside for relief from the stifling heat. And the man Sergeant Westfall had frightened awake was the patriarch. Sure enough, as we started to peel back the layers of all these people sleeping, I mean, it was him, maybe two guys, either his sons or nephews or whatever, and the rest were all women and children, Sergeant Westfall said. We didn't find anything. I can tell you hundreds of stories about things like that, and they would all pretty much be like the one I just told you. Just a different family, a different time, a different circumstance, he said. For Sergeant Westfall, that night was a turning point. I just remember thinking to myself, I just brought terror to someone else under the American flag. And that's just not what I joined the army to do, he said. Intelligence. Again, this is Chris Hedges, The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness, in The Nation magazine. Intelligence. 15 soldiers we spoke with told us the information that spurred these raids was typically gathered through human intelligence and that it was usually incorrect. 8 said it was common for Iraqis to use American troops to settle family disputes, tribal rivalries, or personal vendettas. Sergeant Jesus Bocanegra, 25, of Wescalo, Texas, was a scout in Tikrit with the 4th Infantry Division during a year-long tour that ended in March 2004. In late 2003, Sergeant Bocanegra raided a middle-aged man's home in Tikrit because his son had told the army his father was an insurgent. After thoroughly searching the man's house, soldiers found nothing and later discovered that the son simply wanted money his father had buried at the farm. After persistently acting on such false leads, Sergeant Bocanegra, who raided Iraqi homes in more than 50 operations, said soldiers began to anticipate the innocence of those they raided. People would make jokes about it, even before we'd go on a raid, like, fucking, we're gonna get the wrong house, he said. Because it would always happen. We always got the wrong house. Specialist Crystal said he and his platoon leader shared a joke of their own. Every time he raided a house, he would radio in and say, "This is 31 Lima. Yeah, I found the weapons of mass destruction in here." Sergeant Brune said he questioned the authenticity of the intelligence he received because Iraqi informants were paid by the U.S. military for tips. On one occasion, an Iraqi tipped off Sergeant Brune's unit that a small Syrian resistance organization responsible for killing a number of U.S. troops was holed up in a house. "They're waiting for us to show up, and there will be a lot of shooting," Sergeant Brunes recalls being told. As the Alpha Company team leader, Sergeant Brunes was supposed to be the first person in the door. Skeptical, he refused.
So I said, if you're so confident there are a bunch of Syrian terrorists, insurgents in there, why in the world are you going to send me and three guys in the front door? Because chances are I'm not going to be able to squeeze the trigger before I get shot. Sergeant Bruins facetiously suggested they pull a M2 Bradley fighting vehicle up to the house and shoot a missile through the front window to exterminate the enemy fighters his commanders claimed were inside. They instead diminished the aggressiveness of the raid. As Sergeant Bruins ran security out front, his fellow soldiers smashed the windows and kicked down the doors to find, quote, a few little kids, a woman, and an old man. In late summer 2005, in a village on the outskirts of Kirkuk, Specialist Crystal searched a compound with two Iraqi police officers. A friendly man in his mid-30s escorted Specialist Crystal and others in his unit around the property where the man lived with his parents, wife, and children, making jokes to lighten the mood. As they finished searching, they found nothing. A lieutenant from his company approached Specialist Crystal. "What the hell were you doing?" he asked. "Well, we just searched the house and it's clear," Specialist Crystal said. The lieutenant told Specialist Crystal that his friendly guide was one of the targets of the raid. Apparently, he'd been dimed out by someone as being an insurgent, Specialist Crystal said. For that mission, they'd only handed out the target sheets to officers, and the officers aren't there with the rest of the troops. Specialist Crystal said he felt humiliated because his assessment that the man posed no threat was deemed irrelevant, and the man was arrested. Shortly afterwards, he posted himself in a fighting vehicle for the rest of the mission. Sergeant Larry Cannon, 27, of Salt Lake City, a Bradley gunner with the 18th Infantry Brigade, 1st Infantry Division, served a year-long tour in several cities in Iraq, including Tikrit, Samarra, and Mosul, beginning in February 2004. He estimates that he searched more than 100 homes in Tikrit and found the raids fruitless and maddening. "We would go on one raid of a house, and that guy would say, 'No, it's not me, but I know where that guy is.' And he'd take us to the next house where the target was supposedly at. And then that guy's like, 'No, it's not me. I know where he is, though.' And we'd drive around all night and go from raid to raid to raid." "I can't really fault military intelligence," said Specialist Reppenhagen, who said he raided 30 homes in and around Bakuba. "It was always a guessing game. We're in a country where we don't speak the language. We're light on interpreters. It's just impossible to really get anything. All you're going off is a pattern of what's happened before and hoping that the pattern doesn't change." Sergeant Jeffrey Millard, 26, of Buffalo, New York, served in Tikrit with the Rear Operations Center, 42nd Infantry Division, for 1 year beginning in October 2004. He said combat troops had neither the training nor the resources to investigate tips before acting on them. "We're not the police," he said. "We don't go around like detectives and ask questions. We kick down doors, we go in, we grab people." First Lieutenant Brady Van Eglin, 26, of Washington, D.C., said the Army depended on less than reliable sources because options were limited. He served as a survey platoon leader with the 1st Armored Division in Baghdad's volatile Ahmadiyya district for 8 months, beginning in September 2003. "That's really about the only thing we had," he said. "A lot of it was just going off a whim, a hope that it worked out. Maybe 1 in 10 worked out." Sergeant Bruins said he uncovered illegal material about 10% of the time, an estimate echoed by other veterans. We did find small materials for IEDs, like maybe a small piece of the wire, the detonating cord," said Sergeant Cannon. "We never found real bombs in the houses." In the 1,000 or so raids he conducted during his time in Iraq, Sergeant Westfall said he came into contact with only 4 hardcore insurgents out of thousands of raids. Arrests. Even with such slim pretexts for arrest, some soldiers said any Iraqis arrested during a raid were treated with extreme suspicion. Several reported seeing military-aged men detained without evidence or abused during questioning. 8 veterans said the men would typically be bound with plastic handcuffs, their heads covered in sandbags. While the Army officially banned the practice of hooding prisoners after the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, 5 soldiers indicated that it continued. "You weren't allowed to, but it was still done," said Sergeant Cannon. "I remember in Mosul in January 2005, we had guys in a raid, and they threw them in the back of a Bradley, shackled and hooded. These guys were really throwing up," he continued. "They were so sick and nervous, and sometimes they were peeing on themselves. Can you imagine if people just come into your house and take you in front of your family screaming, and if you actually were innocent but had no way to prove it? It would be a scary, scary thing." Specialist Rippenhagen said he only had a vague idea about what constituted contraband during a raid. Sometimes we didn't even have a translator. So we just find some poster with Mctodol, Sodder, Sistani, or something. We don't know what it says on it. We just apprehend them, document that thing as evidence, and send it on down the road and let other people deal with it. Sergeant Bruins, Sergeant Bocanegra, and others said physical abuse of Iraqis during raids was common. It was just soldiers being soldiers, Sergeant Bocanegra said. You give them a lot of too much power they've never had before, and before you know it, they're the ones kicking these guys while they're handcuffed. And then by you not catching insurgents, when you have someone say, oh, this guy planted a roadside bomb, and you don't even know if it's him or not, you just go in there and kick the shit out of him and take him in the back of a 5-ton, take him to jail. Tens of thousands of Iraqis. Military officials estimate more than 60,000 have been arrested and detained since the beginning of the occupation, leaving their families to navigate a complex, chaotic prison system in order to find them. Veterans we interviewed said the majority of detainees they encountered were either innocent or guilty of only minor infractions. Sergeant Bocanegra said during the first 2 months of the war, he was instructed to detain Iraqis based on their attire alone. They were wearing Arab clothing and military-style boots. They were considered enemy combatants, and you would cuff them and take them in, he said. When you put something like that so broad, you're bound to have, out of 100, you're going to have at least 10 that were, you know, I mean, innocent. Sometime during the summer of 2003, Bocanegra said the rules of engagement narrowed somewhat. I remember on some raids, anybody of military age would be taken, he said. Say, for example, we went to some house looking for a 25-year-old male. We would look at an age group. Anybody from 15 to 30 might be a suspect. Since returning from Iraq, Bocanegra has sought counseling for post-traumatic stress disorder and said his mission is to encourage others to do the same. Specialist Richard Murphy, 28, an Army reservist from Pocono, Pennsylvania, who served as part of his 15-month tour with the 800th Military Police Brigade in Abu Ghraib Prison, said he was often struck by the lack of due process afforded the prisoners he guarded. Specialist Murphy initially went to Iraq in May 2003 to train Iraqi police in the southern city of Al-Hilla, but was transferred to Abu Ghraib in October 2003 when his unit replaced one that was rotating home. He spoke with the nation in October 2006, while not on active duty. Shortly after his arrival there, he realized that the number of prisoners was growing, quote, exponentially, while the amount of personnel remained stagnant. By the end of his six-month stint, Specialist Murphy was in charge of 320 prisoners, the majority of whom he was convinced were unjustly detained. I knew that a large percentage of these prisoners were innocent, he said. Just living with these people for months, you get to see their character. And just listening to the prisoners' stories, I mean, I get the sense that a lot of them were just getting rounded up in big groups. Specialist Murphy said one prisoner, a mentally impaired blind albino who could see, quote, maybe a few feet in front of his face, clearly did not belong in Abu Ghraib. I thought to myself, what could he have possibly done? Specialist Murphy counted the prisoners twice a day. And the inmates would often ask him when they would be released or implore him to advocate on their behalf, which he would try to do through the Judge Advocate General Corps office. The JAG officer Specialist Murphy dealt with would respond that it was out of his hands. He would make his recommendations and he'd send it up to the next higher command, Specialist Murphy said. It was just a snail's crawling progress. The system wasn't working. Prisoners at the notorious facility rioted on November 24, 2003 to protest their living conditions. An Army Reserve Specialist Aiden DiGallo, 25, of Sarasota, Florida, was there. He had deployed with the 320th Military Police Company to Talil Air Base to serve in Nasiriyah and Abu Ghraib for 1 year beginning in April 2003. Unlike the other troops in his unit, he did not respond to the riot. 4 months earlier, he had decided to stop carrying a loaded weapon. 9 prisoners were killed and 3 wounded after soldiers opened fire during the riot, and Specialist Delgado's fellow soldiers returned with photographs of the event. The images, disturbingly similar to the incident described by Sergeant Megia, shocked him. It was very graphic, he said. A head split open. One of them was of 2 soldiers in the back of the truck. They opened the body bags of these prisoners that were shot in the head, and one soldier's got an MRE spoon. He's reaching in to scoop out some of his brain, looking at the camera, and he's smiling. And I said, these are some of our soldiers desecrating someone's body. Something is seriously amiss. I became convinced that this was excessive force, that this was brutality. Specialist Patrick Resta, 29, a National Guardsman from Philadelphia, surged in Jalula, where there was a small prison camp at his base. He was with the 252nd Armored 1st Infantry Division for 9 months beginning in March 2004. He recalled his supervisor telling his platoon point blank, "The Geneva Conventions don't exist at all in Iraq, and that's in writing if you want to see it." The pivotal experience for Specialist Delgado came when in the winter of 2003, he was assigned to battalion headquarters inside Abu Ghraib prison, where he worked with Major David Denena and Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Philibom, both implicated in the Taguba report, the official army investigation into the prison scandal. There, Delgado read reports on prisoners and updated a dry erase board with information on where in the large prison compound detainees were moved and held. "That was when I totally walked away from the Army," Specialist Delgado said. "I read these rap sheets on all these prisoners in Abu Ghraib and what they were there for. I expected them to be terrorists, murderers, insurgents. I looked down this roster to see petty theft, public drunkenness, forged coalition documents. These people are here for petty civilian crimes. These aren't terrorists," he recalled thinking. "These aren't our enemies. They're just ordinary people, and we're treating them this harshly." Specialist Delgado ultimately applied for conscientious objector status, which the Army approved in April 2004. The enemy. Again, Chris Hedges, the other war Iraq vets bear witness at thenation.com. "American troops in Iraq lack the training and support to communicate with or even understand Iraqi civilians, according to 19 interviewees. Few spoke or read Arabic. They were offered little or no cultural or historical education about the country they controlled. Translators were either in short supply or underqualified. Any stereotypes about Islam and Arabs that soldiers and Marines arrived with tended to solidify rapidly in the closed confines of the military and the risky streets of Iraqi cities into crude racism." As Specialist Josh Middleton, 23, of New York City, who served in Baghdad and Mosul with the 2nd Battalion, 82nd Airborne Division from December 2004 to March 2005, pointed out, 20-year-old soldiers went from the humiliation of training, getting yelled at every day if you have a dirty weapon, to the streets of Iraq where it's life and death. And 40-year-old Iraqi men look at us with fear, and we can. Do you know what I mean? We have this power that you can't have. That's really liberating. Life is just knocked down to this primal level. In Iraq, Specialist Middleton said, "A lot of guys really supported that whole concept that, you know, if they don't speak English and they have darker skin, they're not as human as us, so we can do what we want." In the scramble to get ready for Iraq, troops rarely learn more than how to say a handful of words in Arabic, depending mostly on a single manual, a country handbook, a field-ready reference publication published by the Defense Department in September 02. The book, as described by 8 soldiers who received it, has pictures of Iraqi military vehicles, diagrams of how the Iraqi army is structured, images of Iraqi traffic signals and signs, and about 4 pages of basic Arabic phrases such as, "Do you speak English? I am an American. I am lost." Iraqi culture, identity, and customs were, according to at least a dozen soldiers and Marines interviewed by The Nation, openly ridiculed in racist terms, with troops deriding Haji food, Haji music, and Haji homes. In the Muslim world, the word Haji denotes someone who has made the pilgrimage to Mecca. But it is now used by American troops in the same way gook was used in Vietnam, or raghead in Afghanistan. You can honestly see how the Iraqis in general, or even Arabs in general, are being, you know, dehumanized, said Specialist Engelhart. Like, it was very common for United States soldiers to call them derogatory terms like camel jockeys or jihad Johnny or, you know, sand nigger. According to Sergeant Millard and several others interviewed, it becomes this radicalized, racialized hatred toward Iraqis. And this racist language, as Specialist Harmid pointed out, likely played a role in the level of violence directed at Iraqi civilians. Quote, "By calling them names," he said, "they're not people anymore. They're just objects." Several interviewees emphasized that the military did set up for training purposes mock Iraqi villages, people with actors who played the part of civilians and insurgents. But they said that the constant danger in Iraq and the fear it engendered swiftly overtook such training. They were the law, Specialist Harmon said of the soldiers in his unit in Al-Rashidiyah near Baghdad, which participated in raids and convoys. They were very mean-spirited to them. A lot of cursing at them. And I'm like, dude, these people don't understand what you're saying. They used to say a lot, oh, they'll understand when the gun is in their face. Those few veterans who said they did try to reach out to Iraqis encountered fierce hostility from those in their units. Quote, I had the night shift one night at the aid station, said Specialist Resta, recounting one such incident. We were told from the first second that we arrived there, and this was in writing on the wall in our aid station, that we were not to treat Iraqi civilians unless they were about to die. So these guys in the guard tower radioed in, and they say they've got an Iraqi out there that's asking for a doctor. So it's really late at night, and I walk out there to the gate, and I don't even see the guy at first, and they point him out, and he's standing there. Well, I mean, he's sitting, leaned up against this concrete barrier, like the median of a highway. We had, as you approach the gate. And he's sitting there, leaned up against it, and he's out there. If you want to go check on him, he's out there. So I'm sitting there waiting for an interpreter, and the interpreter comes, and I just walk out there in the open. And this guy has the shit kicked out of him. He was missing two teeth. He has a huge laceration on his head. He looked like he had broken his eye orbit and had some kind of injury to his knee. The Iraqi, Specialist Resta, said pleaded with him in broken English for help. He told Specialist Resta that there were men near the base who were waiting to kill him. I open a bag, and I'm trying to get bandages out. And the guys in the guard tower are yelling at me, get that fucking Haji out of here, Specialist Resta said. And I just looked back at them and ignored them. And they were saying, you know, he doesn't look like he's about to die to me. Tell him to go back to the fucking IP, the Iraqi police. And, you know, a bunch of stuff like that. So, you know, I'm kind of ignoring them, and I'm trying to get the story from this guy, and our doctor rolls up in an ambulance, and from 30 to 40 meters away, looks out, shakes his head, and says, you know, he looks fine, he's gonna be alright, and walks back to the passenger side of the ambulance, you know, kind of like, get your ass over here and drive me back up to the clinic. So I'm standing there, and the whole time, both this doctor and the guards are yelling at me, you know, get rid of this guy. At one point, they're yelling at me when I'm saying, no, let's at least keep this guy here overnight until it's light out, because they wanted me to send him back out into the city, where he told me people were waiting for him to kill him. When I asked if he'd be allowed to stay there, at least until it was light out, the response was, are you hearing this shit? I think Doc is part fucking Haji, Specialist Resta said. Specialist Resta gave in to the pressure and denied the man aid. The interpreter, he recalled, was furious, telling him that he had effectively condemned the man to death. So I walk inside the gate, and the interpreter helps him up, and the guy turns around to walk away, and the guy in the guard tower says, tell him if he comes back here tonight, he's going to get fucking shot, Specialist Resta said, and the interpreter just stared at them and looked at me and then looked back at them, and they nod their head like, yeah, we mean it. So he yells it to the Iraqi, and the guy just flinches and turns back over his shoulder, and the interpreter says it again, and he starts walking away again, you know, crying like a little kid. And that was that. What a nice story. I think I'm going to say that, for bedtime reading. For the kids, you know. Two dozen soldiers interviewed said that this callousness toward Iraqi civilians was particularly evident in the operation of supply convoys, operations in which they participated. These convoys are the arteries that sustain the occupation, ferrying items such as water, mail, maintenance parts, sewage, food, and fuel across Iraq. And these strings of tractor trailers, operated by Kellogg Brown and Root, oh, it's just KBR now, and other private contractors, require daily protection by the U.S. military. Typically, according to these interviewees, supply convoys consisted of 20 to 30 trucks stretching half a mile down the road, with a Humvee military escort in front and back and at least one more in the center. Soldiers and Marines also sometimes accompanied the drivers in the cabs of the tractor trailers. These convoys, ubiquitous in Iraq, were also, to many Iraqis, sources of wanton destruction. Again, this is Chris Hedges, the other war Iraq vets bear witness in The Nation magazine, available at thenation.com. According to descriptions culled from interviews with 38 veterans who rode in convoys guarding such runs as Kuwait to Nasiriyah, Nasiriyah to Baghdad, and Balad to Kirkuk, when these columns of vehicles left their heavily fortified compounds, they usually roared down the main supply routes, which often cut through densely populated areas, reaching speeds of over 60 miles an hour. Governed by the rule that stagnation increases the likelihood of attack, convoys leapt meridians and traffic jams, ignored traffic signals, swerved without warning onto sidewalks, scattering pedestrians, and slammed into civilian vehicles, shoving them off the road. Iraqi civilians, including children, were frequently run over and killed. Veterans said they sometimes shot drivers of civilian cars that moved into convoy formations or attempted to pass convoys as a warning to other drivers to get out of the way. A moving target is harder to hit than a stationary one, said Sergeant Ben Flanders, 28, a National Guardsman from Concord, New Hampshire, who served in Balad, the 172nd Mountain Infantry for 11 months beginning in March 2004. Flanders ran convoy routes out of Camp Anaconda, about 30 miles north of Baghdad. So speed was your friend, and certainly in terms of IED detonation, absolutely. Speed and spacing were the two things that could really determine whether or not you were going to get injured or killed, or if they just completely missed, which happened. Following an explosion or ambush, soldiers in the heavily armed escort vehicles often fired indiscriminately in a furious effort to suppress further attacks, according to three veterans. The rapid burst from the belt-fed 50 caliber machine guns and SAWs, squad automatic weapons, which can fire as many as 1,000 rounds per minute, left many civilians wounded or dead. One example I can give you, you know, we'd be cruising down the road in a convoy, and all of a sudden an IED blows up, said Specialist Ben Schrader, 27, of Grand Junction, Colorado. He served in Bakuba with the 263rd Armored Battalion, 1st Infantry Division, from February 04 to February 05. Quote, and you know, you've got these scared kids on these guns, and they just start opening fire, and there could be innocent people everywhere, and I've seen this. I mean, on numerous occasions where innocent people died because we're cruising down and a bomb goes off. Several veterans said IEDs, the preferred weapon of the Iraqi insurgency, were one of their greatest fears. Since the invasion of March 2003, IEDs have been responsible for killing more U.S. troops, 39.2% of the more than 3,600 killed, than any other method, according to the Brookings Institution, which monitors deaths in Iraq. This past May, IED attacks claimed 90 lives, the highest number of fatalities from roadside bombs since the beginning of the war. The second you left the gate of your base, you're always worried, said Sergeant Flat. You are constantly watching for IEDs, and you can never see them. I mean, it's just pure luck who's getting killed and who's not. If you've been in firefights earlier that day or that week, you're even more stressed and insecure to a point where you're almost trigger happy. Sergeant Flat was among 24 veterans who said they had witnessed or heard stories from those in their unit of unarmed civilians being shot or run over by convoys. These incidents, they said, were so numerous that many were never reported. Sergeant Flat recalled an incident in January 2004 when a convoy drove past him on one of the main highways in Mosul. Quote, a car following got too close to the convoy, he said. Basically, they took shots at the car. Warning shots, I don't know. But they shot the car. Well, one of the bullets happened to just pierce the windshield and went straight into the face of this woman in the car. And she was, well, as far as I know, instantly killed. I didn't pull her out of the car or anything. Her son was driving the car, and she had her three little girls in the back seat. And they came up to us because we were actually sitting in a defensive position right next to the hospital, the main hospital in Mosul, the civilian hospital. And they drove up, and she was obviously dead, and the girls were crying. On July 30th, 2004, Sergeant Flanders was riding in the tail vehicle of a convoy in a pitch-black night, traveling from Camp Anaconda south to Taji, just north of Baghdad, when his unit was attacked with small arms fire and RPGs. He was about to get on the radio to warn the vehicle in front of him of the ambush when he saw his gunner unlock the turret and swivel it around in the direction of the shooting. He fired his MK-19, a 40-millimeter automatic grenade launcher capable of discharging up to 350 rounds per minute. He's just holding the trigger down. It wound up jamming, so he didn't get off as many shots maybe as he wanted, Sergeant Flanders recalled. But I said, how many did you get off? Because I knew they would be asking that. He said, 23. He launched 23 grenades. I remember looking out the window, and I saw a little hut, a little Iraqi house with a light on. We were going so fast, and obviously your adrenaline, you're just like tunnel vision, so you can't really see what's going on, you know, and it's dark out and all that stuff. I couldn't really see where the grenades were exploding, but it had to be exploding around the house or maybe even hit the house. Who knows? Who knows? And we were the last vehicle. We can't stop. Convoys did not slow down or attempt to brake when civilians inadvertently got in front of their vehicles, according to the veterans who described them. Sergeant Kelly Doherty, 29, from Cannon City, Colorado, was based at the Talil Air Base in Nasiriyah with the Colorado National Guard's 220th Military Police Company for a year beginning in February 2003. She recounted one incident investigated in January 2004 on a six-lane highway south of Nasiriyah that resembled numerous incidents described by other veterans. It's like a very barren desert, so most of the people that live there, they're no nomadic, or they just live in little villages and have like camels and goats and stuff, she recalled. There was then a little boy. I would say he was about 10, because we didn't see the accident. We responded to it with the investigative team. A little Iraqi boy, and he was crossing the highway with his three donkeys. A military convoy, transportation convoy driving north, hit him and the donkeys and killed all of them. When we got there, there were the dead donkeys, and there was this little boy on the side of the road. We saw him there, and, you know, we were upset because the convoy didn't even stop, she said. They really, judging by the skid marks, hardly even slowed down. But, I mean, that's basically your order, is that you never stop. Among supply convoys, there were enormous disparities based on the nationality of the drivers, according to Sergeant Flanders, who estimated that he ran more than 100 convoys in Balad, Baghdad, Fallujah, and Bakuba. When drivers were not American, the trucks were often old, slow, and prone to breakdowns, he said. The convoys operated by Nepalese, Egyptian, or Pakistani drivers did not receive the same level of security, although the danger was more severe because of the poor quality of their vehicles. American drivers were usually placed in convoys about half the length of those run by foreign nationals, and were given superior vehicles, body armor, and better security. Sergeant Flanders said troops disliked being assigned to convoys run by foreign nationals, especially since when the aging vehicles broke down, they had to remain and protect them until they could be recovered. Quote, it just seemed insane to run civilians around the country, he added. I mean, Iraq is such a security concern, and it's dangerous, and yet we have KBR just riding around unarmed. Remember those terrible judgments that we made about Iraq, what it would look like post-conflict? I think this is another incarnation of that misjudgment, which would be that, oh, it'll be fine, we'll put a Humvee in front, we'll put a Humvee in back, we'll put a Humvee in the middle, and we'll just run with it. It was shocking to me. I was Army trained, and I had a good gunner, and I had radios, and I could call on the radios, I could get an airstrike if I wanted to, I could get a medevac, and here these guys are just tooling around. These guys, they're promised the world. They're promised $120,000 tax-free. And what kind of people take those jobs? Down on their luck type people, you know? Grandmothers. There were grandmothers there. I escorted a grandmother there, and she did great. We went through an ambush, and one of her guys got shot, and she was cool, calm, and collected. Wonderful. Great. Good for her. But what the hell is she doing there? We're using these vulnerable convoys, which probably piss off more Iraqis than it actually helps in our relationship with them, Flanders said. Just so we can have comfort and air conditioning and sodas? Great. And PlayStations and camping chairs and greeting cards and stupid t-shirts that say, who's your Baghdaddy? End quote. Again, Chris Hedges in The Nation, the other war Iraq veterans bear witness. Oh shit, it's already almost noon. Patrol soldiers and Marines who participated in the neighborhood patrol said they often used the same tactics as convoys, speed, aggressive firing, to reduce the risk of being ambushed or falling victim to IEDs. Sergeant Patrick Campbell, 29, of Camarillo, California, who frequently took part in patrols, said his unit fired often and without much warning on Iraqi civilians in a desperate bid to ward off attacks. Every time we got on the highway, he said, we were firing warning shots, causing accidents all the time, cars screeching to a stop, going in the other intersection. The problem is, if you slow down at an intersection more than once, that's where the next bomb is going to be, because you know they watch, you know? And so if you slow down at the same checkpoint every time, guaranteed there's going to be a bomb there the next couple of days. So getting onto a freeway or a highway is a choke point, because you have to wait for traffic to stop. So you want to go as fast as you can, and that involves added risks to all the cars around you, all the civilian cars. The first Iraqi I saw killed was an Iraqi who got too close to our patrol, he said. We were coming up on an on-ramp, and he was coming down the highway, and they fired warning shots, and he just didn't stop. He just merged right into the convoy, and they opened up on him. This took place sometime in the spring of 2005 in Qadamiya, in the northwest corner of Baghdad, Sergeant Campbell said. His unit fired into the man's car with a 240 Bravo, a heavy machine gun. Quote, I heard three gunshots, he said. We got about halfway down the road, and the guy in the car got out, and he's covered in blood. And this is where the impulse is to just keep going. There's no way that this guy knows who we are. We're just like every other patrol that goes up and down this road. I looked at my lieutenant, and it wasn't even a discussion. We turned around, and we went back. So I'm treating the guy. He has three gunshot wounds to the chest, blood everywhere, and he keeps going in and out of consciousness, and he finally stops breathing. I have to give him CPR. I take my right hand, I lift up his chin, I take my left hand and grab the back of his head to position his head. I take my left hand, my hand actually goes into his cranium. So I'm actually holding the man's brain in my hand. And what I realized was I had made a mistake. I had checked for exit wounds, but what I didn't know was the Humvee behind me, after the car failed to stop after the first three rounds, had fired 20, 30 rounds into the car. I never heard it. I heard three rounds. I saw three holes, no exit wounds, he said. I thought I knew what the situation was, so I didn't even treat this guy's injury to the head. Every medic I ever told is always like, of course, I mean, the guy's shot in the head. There's nothing you could have done. I'm pretty sure. I mean, you can't stop bleeding in the head like that. But this guy, I'm watching this guy who I know we shot because he got too close. His car was clean. There was no, he didn't hear it, didn't see us, whatever it was. He dies, you know? Dies in my arms. While other veterans said the killing of civilians deeply disturbed them, they also said there was no other way to safely operate a patrol. You don't want to shoot kids. I mean, no one does, said Sergeant Campbell as he began to describe an incident in the summer of 2005, recounted to him by several men in his unit. But you have this. I remember my unit was coming along this elevated overpass, and this kid is in the trash pile below, pulls out an AK-47 and just decides he's going to start shooting. And you got to understand, when you've spent 9 months in a war zone where no one, every time you've been shot at, you've never seen the person shooting at you, and you could never shoot back. Here's some guy, some 14-year-old kid, it turns out, with an AK-47, decides he's going to start shooting at this convoy. It was the most obscene thing you've ever seen. Every person got out and opened fire on this kid, using the biggest weapons we could find, ripped him to shreds. Sergeant Campbell was not present at the incident, which took place in Katamiya, but he saw photographs and heard descriptions from several eyewitnesses in his unit. Everyone was so happy, like this release that they finally killed an insurgent, he said. Then when they got there, they realized it was just a little kid. And I know that really fucked up a lot of people in the head. They'd show all the pictures, and some people were really happy, like, oh, look what we did. And other people were like, man, I don't ever want to see that again. The killing of unarmed Iraqis was so common that many of the troops said it became an accepted part of the daily landscape. The ground forces were put in that position, said First Lieutenant Wade Zirkel of Shenandoah County, Virginia, who fought in Nasiriyah and Fallujah with the 2nd Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion from March to May 2003. You got a guy trying to kill me, but he's firing from houses with civilians around him, women and children. You know, what do? You don't want to risk shooting at him and shooting children at the same time, but at the same time, you don't want to die either. Sergeant Doherty recounted an incident north of Nasiriyah in December 2003 when her squad leader shot an Iraqi civilian in the back. The shooting was described to her by a woman in her unit who treated the injuries. It was just like the mentality of my squad leader was like, oh, well, we have to kill them over here so we don't have to kill them back in Colorado, she said. He just like seemed to view every Iraqi as a potential terrorist. Several interviewees said on occasion these killings were justified by framing innocents as terrorists, typically followed incidents when American troops fired on crowds of unarmed Iraqis. The troops would then detain those who survived, accusing them of being insurgents, and plant AK-47s next to the bodies of those they had killed to make it seem as if the civilian dead were combatants. It would always be an AK because they have so many of those weapons lying around, said Specialist Oon. Cavalry Scout Joe Hasher, 26, of San Diego, said 9mm handguns and even shovels to make it look like the non-combatant was digging a hole to plant an IED were used as well. And, of course, I've written about that on the anti-war blog before. There have been previous reports of digging holes, planting shovels, and bomb materials on these guys. Every good cop carries a throwaway, said Hatcher, who served with the 4th Cavalry Regiment, 1st Squadron, Ad-Dawar, halfway between Tikrit and Samarra from February 2004 to March 2005. If you kill someone and they're unarmed, you just drop one on them. Those who survived such shootings then found themselves imprisoned as accused insurgents. In the winter of 2004, Sergeant Campbell was driving near a particularly dangerous road in Abu Garth, a town west of Baghdad, when he heard gunshots. Sergeant Campbell, who served as a medic in Abu Garth with the 256th Infantry Brigade from November 2004 to October 2005, was told that Army snipers had fired 50 to 60 rounds at two insurgents who've gotten out of their car to plant IEDs. One alleged insurgent was shot in the knees 3 or 4 times, treated and evacuated on a military helicopter, while the other man, who was treated for glass shards, was arrested and detained. Quote, I come to find out later that while I was treating him, the snipers had planted, after they searched and found nothing, they had planted bomb-making materials on the guy because they didn't want to be investigated for the shoot, Sergeant Campbell said. He showed the nation a photograph of one sniper with a radio in his pocket he later planted as evidence. And to this day, I mean, I remember taking that guy to Abu Ghraib prison, the guy who didn't get shot, and just saying, I'm sorry, because there was not a damn thing I could do about it. I mean, I guess I have a moral obligation to say something, but I would have been kicked out of the unit in a heartbeat. I would have been a traitor. Again, this is Chris Hedges in The Nation. The other war Iraq vets bear witness. Checkpoints. The U.S. military checkpoints dotted across Iraq, according to 26 soldiers and Marines, were stationed at them or supplied them in locals as diverse as Tikrit, Baghdad, Karbala, Samarra, Mosul, and Kirkuk, often were often deadly for civilians. Unarmed Iraqis were mistaken for insurgents, and the rules of engagement were blurred. Troops fearing suicide bombs and rocket-propelled grenades often opened fire on civilian cars. Nine of those soldiers said they had seen civilians being shot at checkpoints. These incidents were so common that the military could not investigate each one, some veterans said. Most of the time, it's a family, said Sergeant Cannon, who served at half a dozen checkpoints in Tikrit. Every now and then, there is a bomb, you know. That's the scary part. There were some permanent checkpoints stationed across the country, but for unsuspecting civilians, flash checkpoints were far more dangerous, according to eight veterans who were involved in setting them up. These impromptu security perimeters, thrown up at a moment's notice and quickly dismantled, were generally designed to catch insurgents in the act of trafficking weapons or explosives, people violating military-imposed curfews, or suspects in bombings or drive-by shootings. Iraqis had no way of knowing where these so-called tactical control points would pop up, interviewees said. So many would turn a corner at high speed and became the unwitting targets of jumpy soldiers and Marines. For me, it was really random, said Lieutenant Van Eglin. I just picked a spot on a map that I thought was a high-volume area that might catch some people. We just set something up for half an hour to an hour, then we'd move on. There were no briefings before setting checkpoints, he said. Temporary checkpoints were safer for troops, according to the veterans, because it was less likely to serve as a static target for insurgents. You do it real quick because you don't always want to announce your presence, said 1st Sergeant Perry Jeffries, 46, of Waco, Texas, who served with the 4th Infantry Division from April to October 2003. The temporary checkpoints themselves varied greatly. Lieutenant Van Eglin set up checkpoints using orange cones of 50 yards of concertina wire. He would assign a soldier to control the flow of traffic and direct traffic through the wires, while others searched the vehicles, questioned drivers, and asked for identification. He said that signs in English and Arabic warned Iraqis to stop at night. Troops used lasers, glow stick, or tracer bullets to signal cars through. When those weren't available, troops improvised by using flashlights sent to them by family and friends back home. Baghdad is not well lit, said Sergeant Flanders. There's not street lights everywhere. You can't really tell what's going on. Other troops, however, said they constructed tactical control points that were hardly visible to drivers. We didn't have cones. We didn't have nothing, recalled Sergeant Bocanegra, who said he served at more than 10 checkpoints in Tikrit. You literally put rocks on the side of the road and tell them to stop. And of course, some cars are not going to see the rocks. I wouldn't even see the rocks myself. According to Sergeant Flanders, the primary concern when assembling checkpoints was protecting the troops serving there. Humvees were positioned so they could quickly drive away if necessary, and the heavy weapons mounted on them were placed in the best possible position to fire on vehicles that attempted to pass through the checkpoint without stopping. And the rules of engagement were often improvised, soldiers said. If we were given a long list of that kind of stuff, to be honest, a lot of time we would look at it and throw it away, said Staff Sergeant James Zulo, 39, a National Guardsman from Juneau, Alaska, who served in Baghdad in the 3rd Battalion, 297th Infantry Regiment for a year beginning in January 2005. A lot has been written at such a high level, it didn't apply. At checkpoints, troops had to make split-second decisions on when to use lethal force, and veterans said fear often clouded their judgments. Sergeant Matt Martin, 31, of Minneapolis, served as a Marine scout sniper outside Fallujah in 2004 and 2005 with the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines. People think that's dangerous, and he is. But I would do anything... I would do that any day of the week rather than being a Marine sitting on a fucking checkpoint looking at cars. No car that passes through a checkpoint is beyond suspicion, said Sergeant Doherty. You start looking at everyone as a criminal. Is this the car that's going to try to run me? Is this the car that has explosives in it? Or is this just somebody who's confused? The perpetual uncertainty, she said, is mentally exhausting and physically debilitating. In the moment, what's passing through your head is this person a threat? Do I shoot to stop or do I shoot to kill? Said Lieutenant Morgenstein, who served in Al-Anbar. Sergeant Medjiu recounted an incident in Ramadi in July 2003 when an unarmed man drove with his young son too close to a checkpoint. The father was decapitated in front of the small, terrified boy by a member of Sergeant Medjiu's unit firing a heavy 50-caliber machine gun. By then, said Sergeant Medjiu, who responded to the scene after the fact, this sort of killing of civilians has long ceased to arouse much interest or even comment. The next month, Sergeant Medjiu returned stateside for a two-week rest and refused to go back, launching a public protest over the treatment of Iraqis. He was charged with desertion, sentenced to a year in prison, and given a bad conduct discharge. During the summer of 2005, Sergeant Malardi served as an assistant to a general in Tikrit, attended a briefing on checkpoint shooting in which his role was to flip PowerPoint slides. Quote, this unit sets up the traffic control point. This 18-year-old kid is on top of an armored Humvee with a 50-caliber machine gun. And his car speeds at him pretty quick, and he makes a split-second decision that that's a suicide bomber, and he presses the butterfly trigger and puts 200 rounds in less than a minute into this vehicle. It killed the mother, a father, and two kids. The boy was aged 4, and the daughter was aged 3. And they briefed this to the general, and they briefed it gruesome. I mean, they had pictures. They briefed it to him. And this colonel turns around to this full division staff and says, if these fucking Hajis learned to drive, this shit wouldn't happen. Whether or not commanding officers shared this attitude, interviewee said troops were rarely held accountable for shooting civilians at checkpoints. 8 veterans described the prevailing attitude among them as better to be tried by 12 men than carried by 6. Since the number of troops tried for killing civilians is so scant, interviewees said they would risk court-martial over the possibility of injury or death. Rules of engagement. Indeed, several troops said the rules of engagement were fluid and designed to ensure their safety above all else. Some said they were simply told they were authorized to shoot if they felt threatened, and what constituted a risk to their safety was open wide to interpretation. Basically, it always came down to self-defense and better them than you, says Sergeant Bobby Yen, 28 of Atherton, California, who covered a variety of Army activities in Baghdad and Mosul as part of the 222nd Broadcast Operations Detachment for 1 year beginning in November 03. Cover your own butt was the first rule of engagement, Lieutenant Van Eglin confirmed. Someone could look at me the wrong way, and I could claim my safety was in threat. Lack of a uniform policy from service to service, base to base, and year to year forced troops to rely on their own judgment, Sergeant Jeffries explained. Quote, we didn't get straight-up rules, he said. We got things like, don't be aggressive, or try not to shoot if you don't have to. Well, what does that mean? Prior to deployment, Sergeant Flanders said troops were trained on the 5 S's of escalation of force. Shout a warning, shove, show a weapon, shoot non-lethal ammunition in a vehicle's engine block or tires, and shoot to kill. Some troops said they had carried the rules in their pockets or helmets on a small laminated card. Quote, the escalation of force methodology was meant to be a guide to determine courses of action you should attempt before you shoot, he said. Shove might be a step that gets skipped in a given situation. In vehicles at night, how does shout work? Each soldier is not only drilled on the 5 S's, but their inherent right of self-defense. And the fact that they're the aggressors notwithstanding. Some interviews said their commanders discouraged the system of escalation. There's no such thing as warning shot, Specialist Restis says he was told during his plea deployment training at Fort Bragg. I even specifically remember being told it was better to kill them than to have somebody wounded and still alive. Lieutenant Morgenstein said when he arrived in Iraq in August 2004, the rules of engagement barred the use of warning shots. We're trained that if somebody is not armed and they are not a threat, you never fire a warning shot because there's no need to shoot at all. You signal to them with other means than bullets. If they are armed and they are a threat, you never fire a warning shot because this just gives them a chance to kill you. I don't recall at this point if this was a rule of engagement explicitly or simply part of our consistent training. But later on, he said, we were told the ROE was changed. Now, warning shots were now explicitly allowed in certain circumstances. Sergeant Westfall said that by the time he arrived in Iraq in earlier in 2004, the rules of engagement for checkpoints were more refined, at least where he served in the Army in Tikrit. If they didn't come, stop, you were to fire a warning shot, says Sergeant Westfall, and if they continued to come, you were instructed to escalate and point your weapon at their car. If they didn't stop, then if you felt you were in danger and they're about to run your checkpoint or blow you up, you could engage. In his initial training, Lieutenant Morgenstein said Marines were cautioned against the use of warning shots because others around you could be hurt by a stray bullet. And in fact, such incidents were not unusual. One evening in Baghdad, Sergeant Zulo recalled a van roared up to a checkpoint where another platoon in his company was stationed, and a soldier fired a warning shot that bounced off the ground and killed the van's passenger. That was a big wake-up call, he said. After that, we discouraged warning shots of any kind. Many checkpoint incidents went unreported, a number of veterans indicated, and the civilians killed were not included in the overall casualty count. Yet judging by the number of checkpoint shootings described to the nation by veterans we interviewed, such shootings appear to be quite common. Sergeant Flatt recounted one incident in Mosul in January 05 when an elderly couple zipped past a checkpoint. The car was approaching what was, in my opinion, a very poorly marked checkpoint, or not even a checkpoint at all, and probably didn't even see the soldiers, he said. The guys got spooked and decided it was a possible threat, so they shot up the car, and they literally sat in the car for the next 3 days while we drove by them day after day. In another incident, a man was driving his wife and 3 children in a pickup truck on a major highway north of Euphrates near Ramadi on a rainy day in February or March 2005 when the man failed to stop at the checkpoint A Marine in a light armored vehicle fired on the car, killing the wife and critically wounding his son. According to Lieutenant Morgenstein, a civil affairs officer, a JAG official, gave the family condolences and about $3,000 in compensation. I mean, it's a terrible thing because there's no way to pay money to replace a family member, said Lieutenant Morgenstein, who was sometimes charged with apologizing to families for accidental deaths and offering them such compensation, called condolence payments, or solatia. But it's an attempt to compensate for some of the costs of the funeral and all the expenses. It's an attempt to make a good faith offering and a sign of regret and to say, you know, we didn't want this to happen. This is by accident. According to a May report from the Government Accountability Office, the Defense Department issued nearly $31 million in Salatia and the condolence payments between 2003 and 6 to civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan who were killed, injured, or incurred property damage as a result of U.S. or coalition forces' action during combat. The study characterized the payments as expressions of sympathy or remorse, but not an admission of legal liability or fault. In Iraq, according to the report, civilians are paid up to $2,500 for death, as much as $1,500 for serious injuries, and $200 or more for minor injuries. Again, this is Chris Hedges, The Other War. Iraq vets bear witness in The Nation magazine. On one occasion in Ramadi, late 2004, a man happened to drive down a road with his family minutes after a suicide bomber had hit a barrier during a cordon and search operation. Lieutenant Morgenstein said the car's brakes failed and the Marines fired. The wife and her two children managed to escape from the car, but the man was fatally hit. The family was mistakenly told that he had survived. So Lieutenant Morgenstein had to set the record straight. I've never done this before, he said. I had to go tell this woman that her husband was actually dead. We gave her money. We gave her like 10 crates of water. We gave the kids, I remember, maybe it was soccer balls and toys. We didn't know what else to do. One such incident, which took place in Fallujah in March 2003 and was reported on at the time by the BBC, even involved a group of plainclothes Iraqi policemen. Sergeant Medjia was told about the event by several soldiers who witnessed it. The police officers were riding in a white pickup truck chasing a BMW that had raced through a checkpoint. The guy that the cops were chasing got through, and so I guess the soldiers got scared or nervous, so when the pickup truck came, they opened fire on it. The Iraqi police tried to cease fire, but when the soldiers would not stop, they defended themselves, and there was a firefight between the soldiers and the cops. Not a single soldier was killed, but 8 cops were. And I'm all out of time, and I'm sorry, I thought I was going to be able to cram this whole article in. I was almost down to the end. Damn it. Oh, well, I'm sorry, I got to get Brendan O'Neill on the line here. I'm already running late. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9. If you want to read the rest of that article, finish up. It's called The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness. It's on the Viewpoints page at antiwar.com. It's by Chris Hedges and Lelia Al-Arian. The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9, Austin, Texas, and we'll be right back after this.
Just doing my thing. magic number. It's the magic number. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born three, Mace Dub and me, and that's the magic number.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure. Measure in the music races three parts. Casually see, but don't do like the soul. Cause seeing and doing are actions for monkeys. Doing hip hop, hustle, no rock and roll. Unless your name's Brewster, cause Brewster's a punk. Parents let go, cause it's magic in the air. Criticizing rap, so you're out of order. Stop looking, listen to the phrasing Fred Astaire's. And don't get offended while Mace Do-Si-Do's your daughter. A dry camera roll system is now set. Fly around the store under Daisy production. It stands for the inner sound. Y'all in your Quebec, that the action's not a trick, but showing the function. Everybody wants to be a DJ, everybody wants to be an MC, but being speakers are the best, and you don't have to guess. De La Soul Posse consists of three, and that's the magic number. This here piece of the pie is not dessert, but the course that we dine. And three out of every darn time, the effect is when a daisy grows in your mind. Showing true position, this here piece is kissing the part of the pie that's missing with that negative number.
All right, folks, welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and introducing our guest today, Brendan O'Neill. He is the editor of Spiked Online. He's written for just about every newspaper in the world, including the Sunday Times, the Guardian, Salon, Slate, American Prospect, the American Conservative, Reason, the Christian Science Monitor, and a couple of dozen others. He's working on a book right now called Bosnia to Beslan, How the West Spread Al-Qaeda, and he's got a new one in the American Conservative magazine called The Bosnian Connection, the civil war that inspired both liberal hawks and Islamic jihadists. Welcome to the show, Brendan.
Hi, good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. A very interesting article here in the American Conservative magazine. In fact, before we get to that, if it's okay with you, I wanted to... there was this great quote. Oh, here, I got the right window open now here. I saw this, your most recent blog entry... that spiked online. You're talking about Ayman al-Zawahiri's new tape and how Al-Qaeda represents the culture of victimhood that I guess originated in California somewhere and is now spread across the West. And I love this quote. So here we have a terrorist. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Zawahiri lashing out about Salman Rushdie being knighted. You're right. So here we have a terrorist who's stuck in a dugout criticizing a queen who has long since ceased to have any real power for awarding a writer who made a perceived insult against Islam 18 years ago with an order of chivalry for his contributions to an empire that does not exist.
Yeah, I think that really sums up the whole war against terror. The whole thing is just captured in that bizarre statement made by Al-Zawahiri.
It really is kind of like an episode of Monty Python, isn't it?
Indeed, yes, absolutely.
And, you know, this is something a friend of mine named Chad made the observation that in American society, and apparently this is the way it works in Europe and even in the East now, too, there's no longer any difference between a victim and a hero. We can't differentiate those things. So if you can't do anything wonderful, you can at least cry about all the terrible things that are happening to you instead.
That's right, yeah. And I really do think Al-Qaeda is the most extreme expression of that. You know, it really does feed off and feed into the victim culture. And, you know, on a more serious note, I do think that... You know, in reference to the American Conservative piece, I think that has its origins in many ways in the Bosnian conflict. It was really that conflict which allowed Muslims, or some Muslims, to begin to view themselves as the victims of a terrible international conspiracy. And if you look at bin Laden's statements over the past 10 or 15 years, he often says things like, the West doesn't care about Muslims, the West neglected us in Bosnia, the West allowed us to be slaughtered by the barbarian Serbs. And a lot of his anger and his feeling of humiliation, which he thinks justifies his violence, comes from the kind of arguments that were used during the Bosnian conflict. So I think that's it's an interesting journey from what happened in Bosnia to the way in which Al-Qaeda now executes acts of what I would call violent victimhood.
Uh-huh. And it's interesting because, you know, like Michael Scheuer in his book Imperial Hubris, he lists the six very concrete foreign policies that bin Laden cites as reasons why people ought to join his movement and, you know, kill Jews and crusaders and so forth like that. But you're pointing out here that really all of his rhetoric is really heavily loaded with this boo-hoo, poor me, rather than just, you know, hey, they're occupying our land and killing our people, and that's not right. It's actually full of all this kind of left-wing complaining.
It really is. And if you read his statements carefully, you'll notice that he says he sometimes talks about occupation and things like that, but he most often talks about humiliation and degradation, and he talks about how the Muslims have been humiliated and embarrassed and, you know, had their dignity taken away by the West. And he talks about, you know, how the West ignores Muslim victims. We don't shed tears for Muslim victims. We only shed tears for Western victims. And it really is this kind of, it's like he's demanding recognition of his suffering in the way in which throughout the West, as you say, in the therapy culture, there is now a general trend towards seeking recognition for your pain and seeking recognition for your suffering and your trials and tribulations. And I think Al-Qaeda does the same thing. Its bombs are really bombs for recognition. It's a demand that we feel their pain, we recognize their suffering. So it's very different from the kind of political violence of the past, which was political violence designed to win territory or to win an argument or to win a political goal. I think what we have with Al-Qaeda is really therapeutic violence. It's violence aimed at, you know, winning our pity and our sympathy and, you know, and having an equality of victimhood.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they may have a point. I mean, to the degree that they're whining, I guess we can make fun of them. But well, for example, I just finished reading through this new article by Chris Hedges in The Nation magazine, where they've gone through and talked with dozens and dozens of veterans about what it's like to be an occupying soldier in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And what they talk about is how they kill civilians all the time and how they call them Hajis so that it's okay. And, you know, from Bin Laden's point of view, that seems like a pretty legitimate complaint.
Yeah, there's no question that the West, you know, as I've written and as antiwar.com has covered brilliantly over the past number of years, there's no question that the West is oppressing and causing huge problems in the Middle East with its invasions, its support for various problematic regimes and so on. But what's interesting about Al-Qaeda, as distinct from Fatah and Hamas and Hezbollah and various other groups, which I think are different, what's interesting about Al-Qaeda, it's not really a political response to those problems. It's not really a liberationist response to those issues. It's more a kind of, as you say, whining, complaining response. So I think Al-Qaeda is right on one level, in the sense that, you know, obviously the West is causing huge problems in the Middle East, but what's interesting about them is that they don't put forward a political solution to it.
Right. Well, and that's really because as you define in your article here, what we're talking about is a group of people who couldn't possibly be the government of anything. They're a bunch of leftover jihadist fighters from the Afghan war against the Russians that the West supported, and now they're out of work. They're not the type of people who could set up a government even if they tried to. They're the soldiers.
That's right. I think what's most striking about Al-Qaeda, I mean, I would say that they're the creation of two periods of Western intervention. Firstly, the one that most people are familiar with, which was Western intervention in Afghanistan in the late 70s and throughout the 80s, when, as we all know very well, America and Britain in particular pumped millions of pounds into training and arming and propagandizing on behalf of the Mujahideen there. And that's where Al-Qaeda first came together. That's where Bin Laden first became this kind of recruiter of international holy warriors to fight against the Soviets at the time. And then the second period of Western intervention, which is discussed much less, is Bosnia and what happened there. And it's interesting because it happens at precisely the time that Afghanistan becomes a problem for the Mujahideen. In 1992, when the Soviets withdrew in 1989, and between 1989 and 1992, Afghanistan began to descend into civil war between various Mujahideen factions. And the foreign Mujahideen found it very difficult to go back home because Algeria and Egypt and various other regimes were imprisoning and repressing returning Mujahideen forces. So what happened for them, which was very convenient in many ways, is that the Bosnian War breaks out in 1992. And so you have a kind of massive movement of Mujahideen from Afghanistan into Bosnia. Between about 1,500 and 3,000 went there altogether. And they joined with the Bosnian Muslim Army, which at the time was being armed and trained by American forces. And lots of the Mujahideen were directly inspired and enthused and inflamed by Western media coverage. Lots of the Mujahideen who went to Bosnia say that they went there because they read media stories about concentration camps and rape camps. They read about how awful and evil the Serbs were. And so in many ways, I would argue that the Mujahideen were created by Western intervention in Afghanistan, but they were globalized with the help of Western intervention in Bosnia. So I think that's the key thing. The seed was sown in Afghanistan, but it really flourished and grew and became something quite terrible as a result of the Bosnian conflict.
Mm-hmm. Now, did the governments in Great Britain and the United States know that, hey, the Bin Laden types are sending their shock troops from all over the world to come to Bosnia to fight, and that's whose side we're taking?
Yes. The British government didn't have involvement. The British government had a fairly hands-off approach during the Bosnian conflict, mostly, although its diplomatic interventions were often quite problematic and exacerbated tensions on all sides. But the American government, particularly under Clinton from 1993 onwards, were well aware that the Bosnian Muslim Army had large numbers of Mujahideen in its ranks. I've got UN communiques from 93, 94 and 95, in which United Nations officials on the ground in Bosnia are saying to each other, there are 700 and then 1,000 and then 1,200 Mujahideen in the Bosnian Muslim Army. They're quite uncontrollable. They're quite violent. They are doing terrible things. It was very widely known. And at precisely that time, America was secretly supplying the Bosnian Muslim Army with weapons and training. And also it was protecting the movement of finances from radical Islamic charities in Sudan and the Middle East, protecting the movement of these kind of money from these charities into Bosnia. The Washington Post reported in 1996 that American officials on the ground in Bosnia told other officials not to interfere with these movements of money from radical Islamic charities into Bosnia and to allow them to continue, because it was sympathetic to the Bosnian Muslim cause and wanted the Bosnian Muslims to be armed and to be financed. So America played quite the key role in allowing the movement of Mujahideen into Bosnia, and particularly in training the military machine that the Mujahideen were attached to. And in 1995 in particular, as the Bosnian Civil War was coming to its kind of horrendous, bloody conclusion, the Mujahideen were used quite regularly by the Bosnian Muslim Army, and they were used as shock troops, kind of attack dog forces. They were often sent in at the beginning of a Bosnian Muslim Army expedition. They would be sent off at the start to kind of do some really terrible damage to spread fear into the Serb forces. And then the Bosnian Muslim Army would follow on and continue the fighting. So they were used in a very serious and quite upfront fashion by an army that was being armed by Washington.
You're listening to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the phone with Brendan O'Neill from London, England. He's the editor of Spiked Online. He's working on a book right now called Bosnia to Beslan, How the West Spread Al-Qaeda. And now, Brendan, if I remember right, there was kind of a political correctness about the backing of the Mujahideen in the 1990s and the Muslims all around in the Bosnian conflict and later the Kosovo conflict. And if I remember right, it was even said at the time, I don't know if by the administration or only in the press, that this was kind of an attempt to head off the culture war, to head off the clash of civilizations, to show the Muslims that we care about them too, and that sort of thing. And that's why Bill Clinton did such a good job of backing the Mujahideen and so forth.
Yeah, that I've heard that argument put forward by many people as well, and lots of people will now say, why are the Muslims so angry with us? Don't they remember that we supported them in Bosnia and we supported them in Kosovo? I think it's important in this discussion to remember just how kind of quite cynical and opportunistic American support for the Muslims in Bosnia and Kosovo was. I don't think it was driven by real practical sympathy for the Muslims there. I think it was driven by real politic considerations and by a desire on the part of Washington to reestablish its moral credentials, to show that it's a powerful military and moral force, and to throw its weight around in the post-Cold War ever-changing European field to kind of reassert its authority on that level. And I think it was just quite convenient for them to attach themselves to the Muslim side and also to demonize the Serbs in a quite dramatic fashion. And so the irony, of course, is that while people say that this was an attempt, as you say, to offset claims of a clash of civilizations, in fact, it exacerbated those problems because the Bosnian War was presented very much in terms of a straightforward black and white conflict between good and evil, with the Muslims as the kind of good victims and the Serbs as the kind of terrible, awful, fascistic, Nazi-style, wicked murderers. And that was the very, very simplistic presentation of the war by the State Department and by a huge number of quite slavish journalists, actually. So it's ironic that, in fact, what the Bosnian conflict did was to recreate the clash of civilizations idea in a new way and to give rise to a very moralistic, almost religious view of international affairs, which, of course, has now been inherited by President Bush.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, just further expanded upon the lesson that bin Laden and his friends learned in fighting the Russians, which was if you just believe in God enough, you can defeat anybody. And here we just helped them prove it again, right, by helping them gain their independence from Serbia and so forth.
That's right. I think what's quite interesting, I think, about the two fighting experiences that the Mujahideen had is that in Afghanistan, they were the key thing about Afghanistan, I think, is that it brought together international forces. It first gave certain holy warriors the idea that they could become an international global force. It gave them the idea, but it didn't make it reality. And in fact, most of the Mujahideen who fought in Afghanistan were still defined by old Cold War ideas of kind of nation state and ideology and fighting in order to create a government. They were still restrained by those traditional Cold War ideas. What happens then in Bosnia a few years later is that they're kind of liberated from those ideas and they become, the Mujahideen in Bosnia were literally just a force who were there to fight against evil. It was discussed in a very moralistic sense. And the Mujahideen who went to Bosnia went there because, as Evan Coleman says in his book on the Mujahideen in Bosnia, he points out that they thought there was a very clear divergence between good and evil in Bosnia. So what happens is that, whereas in Afghanistan, the Mujahideen were, there was an element of control. They had limited aims. They were religious nationalists. What happens then in Bosnia is that they're let loose from those old ideas and they become a purely moralistic force, tackling evil, as the West described it. So I think that's really key to the transformation of the Mujahideen from religious nationalists as they were in the 80s to what they are today, which is a very brutal, super moralized force who see themselves as kind of having no responsibility to nation states. They don't recognize any borders and they execute acts to express a really kind of moralistic outrage.
Wow, who would have thought that actions have consequences. That's incredible. You know, you even indicate in your article that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi Youssef's uncle and the guy that ran the September 11th attack, that he and at least two of the hijackers had experience fighting in Bosnia. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two of the hijackers either trained or fought in Bosnia. So did one of the suspects in the Madrid train bombings. And in fact, he was directly inspired to go to Bosnia by media coverage. By media coverage that claimed there was concentration camps there on a par with what happened in Nazi Germany. He saw that, he went to Bosnia, he became moralized by that experience. The people who oversaw the bombing of the African embassies in 1998 also had links to Bosnia. There are numerous terrorist incidents over the past 5 to 10 years where the practitioners or the financiers have all been people who fought or trained or worked somehow in relation to the Bosnian Mujahideen. So in many ways, you know, people often talk about al-Qaeda as blowback for mistakes in the Cold War, as a kind of an explosive force coming back to haunt us because of what Reagan and Thatcher did in the 1980s. But in many ways, I think we ought to see al-Qaeda as blowback for Bosnia and as blowback for the West's moralization of that conflict. And it's what it started to do in relation to Bosnia, which was to discuss international affairs in terms of good and evil. I think al-Qaeda is blowback for that. And what we did in Bosnia is now coming back to haunt us in the form of a new terrifying form of terrorism.
Would I be right to say that the role of the Bosnian conflict in the creation, the formation, and the internationalization, as you call it, of Al-Qaeda is the most ignored part of the story? That, I mean, this seems to me like something that is very rarely discussed when Bill Clinton took Osama's side in Bosnia.
Yeah, it's very rarely discussed. A few more books are coming out now, and it's starting to be discussed more. But it's worth remembering, of course, that huge sections of the Western media accepted the State Department's line on Bosnia. And in fact, they often wrote the State Department's line for it. Journalists in America and Britain in particular were really quite vociferous in their denunciations of the Serbs as fascists and in their defense of the Muslims as, you know, a kind of pure, dignified force. And it was really, they imposed a very simplistic fairy tale version of events onto what was in fact a horrid civil war in which all sides committed terrible atrocities. And I think that very simplistic reading, the way in which the media invested so much of its energies into supporting Western intervention in Bosnia, means that it's become a blind spot for them. So they are not critically minded at all in relation to Bosnia. As you know, there's an interesting professor at Amsterdam University called Professor Cees Vibes, and he's written about the Mujahideen in Bosnia, and he says that his experiences is that people always say to him, how can you say this? You know, and he says that you are only allowed to see Bosnia in black and white. There's no critical thinking allowed. And I think that's one reason why the Mujahideen's role in Bosnia is not explored in very much detail.
I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Brendan O'Neill, the editor of Spiked Online. And now, you mentioned in one of your answers, a couple of answers back there, that there were not ideological interests, but very real-world kind of interests at play in terms of America or American policymakers figuring out excuses to maintain military dominance over Europe. And I remember actually around that time, I guess, Margaret Thatcher giving speeches denouncing the idea of the creation of a permanent European army outside of NATO. And it was a big fight over whether Europe was going to have their own army and NATO was going to break up, or whether America would be able to surround old Europe with all the former Warsaw Pact states and bring them into NATO, which is basically, it seems like, what happened. So I guess if all those kind of very high-level power politics are at play, then the left-wing journalists and columnists and so forth who supported this war were really just their willing dupes, basically. They're useful dupes.
I think that's right. I think it's really important to remember the role that the West played in causing the conflict in Bosnia and also in sustaining it over a period of 3 years. And it's, if we think not just America, but if we think about Germany's role, I mean, Germany, you know, coming out of the Cold War, newly reunited, decided to use the conflict in the Balkans as a way of reasserting its kind of its domination of Europe and its power. So, for example, Germany recognized Croatia early on in 1992, and that led to a deepening of tensions between Croatia and other forces and generated conflict as well. America got in on the act by recognizing Bosnia unilaterally, and as predicted, that led to an intensification of the conflict. So I think the way in which the great powers kind of piled into the Balkans and all started taking various different sides and, you know, arming or supporting or recognizing different sides really did exacerbate the conflict and sustained it over that period of time. And I think journalists were, in many ways, their willing dupes. But they also, even more than that, I think they played a key role in encouraging the West to continue with its kind of great power clashes in the field of the Balkans. So journalists played a very important role in arguing that this was a simple conflict between good and evil, in demanding Western intervention. So when Clinton eventually did get around to using NATO to bomb the Bosnian Serbs in 1995, he could say it was in response to demand. It was in response to public concern and public demand as represented by these laptop bombardiers who were demanding continuously that the West should bomb the evil Serbs. So I think on one level, it's absolutely correct. These journalists just swallowed up all the stuff that was told to them by the State Department and by other government agencies in the West. And they also played an even more problematic role, which is that they in turn fed propaganda opportunities back to these Western governments. And so there was a very strange and problematic alliance during that conflict between Western governments and journalists who just abandoned any sense of independence and went along with what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And now I want to pick on Christopher Hitchens here in a minute if I can, but first I wanted to go back to something that you just said about, well, Germany recognized Croatia and then America recognized Bosnia. Help me out with this, because I'm actually, you know, pretty ignorant about the Balkans War. I mean, I know a lot about it, but then again, there's so much to know about it that my knowledge amounts to not very much. But can you confirm for me whether it was the case that basically Richard Holbrooke came and said, okay, we have these kind of vague borders that are not really enforced, but the country's breaking up and the different ethnicities are more or less moving from this side of the river to that side of the river and so forth. And then is it the case that Holbrooke just said, okay, listen, all these soft lines are now hard national borders, and that's what really left so many people, quote-unquote, stuck on the wrong side of the lines and led to a lot of the killing?
Yeah, well, what happened is that there was obviously a great amount of division and tension in the Balkans, particularly following the end of the Cold War, you know, Yugoslavia having been a kind of key aspect in Cold War politics in terms of the different things that it was balancing out. You know, it was very much influenced by the West, but it was also under the control of, you know, communist forces. And so it fell out badly as a result of the end of the Cold War and the end of those old East-West certainties. So there was a rise of tensions. There were more conflicts between the various different groups who had been lumped together into the Yugoslav state. But what I think Western intervention did is that it kind of tipped these tensions over the edge. It imbued them with an international purpose. It kind of really stoked the flame, so to speak. So when Germany recognized Croatia, almost straight away there was conflict then. And the Croatians began to arm, to train, to prepare themselves for war, because they knew that once they had been recognized, once they had succeeded, once they had become their own state, there would be repercussions as a result of that. Similarly, when America unilaterally decided to recognize Bosnia-Herzegovina, a state which has, you know, Croatians, Muslims, and Serbs all within its borders, it was widely known and it was widely predicted, including by officials in the State Department, that that would lead to pretty terrible conflict. And within days, conflict had begun and then kind of went downhill from there. So I think the Western powers played a very inflammatory game in the Balkans, where in order to boost their own standing and to assert their own power, they played a game of recognition and a game of one-upmanship, which meant that for the people on the ground, there was war and there was bloodshed, while the governments in the West could sit back and say, we've done our job, let's see what happens next.
Now, you say the State Department predicted it, and then they went ahead anyway. Were they doing this on purpose, trying to make the war worse, or they just didn't care?
Well, that's a very good question. Who knows the answer to that? But there were individuals within the State Department and other officials within Washington who said, if we take this action and recognize Bosnia, there will be a problem. It will intensify what's happening there. So it was recognized, but the question of why Washington did it, I mean, was there a conscious strategy? I mean, that sounds a bit too much like a conspiracy theory to me, I have to say. But certainly it looked like a reckless act, and one which anyone with three or four brain cells would have known would have led on to other problematic situations. So I think there was an element of recklessness in it, an element of certainly wanting to stand up to Germany, which was getting more and more involved in the Balkans. It was a real kind of drive to all the various Western powers were attracted to the Balkans as a place where they could assert themselves, particularly in the kind of confusing period of the post-Cold War era, assert themselves, assert their authority, assert their interests. And they don't seem to have cared very much for the consequences on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, three or four brain cells, that would count Richard Holbrooke out. Okay, so now let's turn to some of the specifics in your article here. Well, we've been covering some of them, but I want to turn to Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, yeah.
And your coverage of him. And in this article, it's called The Bosnian Connection, the civil war that inspired both liberal hawks and Islamist jihadis. It's in the American Conservative magazine, and I'm sorry, I didn't look it up. Is it online, or is it only in print? Do you know?
I think it's only in print, but it's on my website.
Okay, there you go. And that's BrendanO'Neill.net, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Yes, it's Brendan O'Neill. He's the editor of Spiked Online, and that's his own personal website, BrendanO'Neill.net, where you can read this article, The Bosnian Connection. And I just think this is funny because I'm sure you probably saw just in the last couple of days, was it the New Standard or one of these magazines came forward and said, "Hey, everybody, look at this Christopher Hitchens article from 1976 about what a great guy Saddam Hussein is." And so, you know, we all get a kick out of seeing, you know, one of the written word's most prominent warmongers, laptop bombardiers, as you call them, constantly switching back from who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And it's not just Saddam Hussein that he used to praise and then turn to demonize in the run-up to war. But it's the Mujahideen and the Al-Qaeda movement in general used to have a very big fan in the form of Christopher Hitchens. Is that right?
Yeah, well, one of the most interesting things of all, I think, about the Bosnian conflict is one of the strangest alliances that took place during that conflict was a kind of alliance of a meeting of minds between liberal left-wing journalists in the West and holy warriors from the East. And it's really striking because what I write about in the American Conservative is the fact that, you know, Christopher Hitchens wrote a piece recently for Vanity Fair in which he was talking about the rise of radical Islam. And he mentioned a guy called Omar Sheikh, who's a British Muslim who was radicalized in the 1990s and later went on to murder Daniel Pearl. He's now in prison in Pakistan. And Hitchens uses him as an example of the problem of Islamic radicalism, which is sending these British citizens to, you know, turn crazy and so on. And what I point out in my article, the really interesting thing is that actually Christopher Hitchens and Omar Sheikh have a lot in common, which is they were both radicalized and transformed by the same thing, which was the war in Bosnia. So Omar Sheikh saw footage of Bosnian Muslims being persecuted in 1992 when he was a student at the London School of Economics. And he took it upon himself to go to Bosnia, where he joined the Mujahideen, and then from there on he kind of went into a life of terrorism. At precisely the same time, in 1992, Hitchens also became transformed by what was happening to the Bosnian Muslims, and he says that that was the thing that first got him interested in the neocons and first led him to realize that neocon-supported Western intervention was a good thing. So what's really striking is that both this kind of crazy radical Islamist terrorist and this American-British journalist became radicalized at the same time by the same thing, and they were on the same side. And that happens across the board. You realize that there are quite a few kind of liberal hawks out there who today spend all their time denouncing Al-Qaeda, but who 15 years ago were actually on the same side. And the most vociferous supporters of the Bosnian Muslims and critics of the Bosnian Serbs were two sets of people, liberal journalists in the West and holy warriors from the East. And I think that's the most interesting thing. And since then, there's been a divergence. But it's worth, I think, people bearing in mind that both those groups of people have their origins in the Bosnian War when they were definitely on the same side.
Interesting, too, that this is a time when Americans can look back and remember Republicans posing as though they were the peaceniks and saying, "Hey, what are we doing here? What's the exit strategy? We're not the policeman of the world. Why are we backing Al-Qaeda in Bosnia, etc.?"
Yeah, well, that's a really good point, because I was thinking about this the other day. And what's really striking is, I don't know if you remember, but when Clinton was running for president, he said he wouldn't go abroad very much. You know, he'd stay at home. And his big thing was, it's the economy, stupid. And, you know, he promised that he would be kind of a home-based president. And then, lo and behold, he gets into power, and within months, he's in Bosnia, and then later on, he bombs Iraq in 1998. He bombs Kosovo and Yugoslavia again in 1999. And that's really striking. And then the exact same thing happens with the Bush administration, where in the run-up to when they were campaigning, remember Condoleezza Rice saying that we were, you know, America were going to be more isolationist and we're going to kind of come home again. And, you know, the complaint in Europe then was that, oh, no, we're going to lose America as a great force in the world because the Bushies are going to go home. And then precisely the same thing happens. They get into power obviously 9/11 happens, and then they're in Afghanistan, they're in Iraq, and they become one of the most outwardly focused administrations in recent memory. So I'm quite struck by that. There seems to be something about getting into power which kind of draws presidents and their administrations into conflict almost straight away. So there's something interesting going on there, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and although in the case of Bush, I think he was simply lying because, of course, they bombed, they did, cranked up the degree of the bombings of the no-fly zones within his first month in power. Yeah. They bombed the hell out of Iraq. And of course, he answered in an interview during the silly Florida recount in the early winter at the end of the year 2000 there. He was asked in an interview with 60 Minutes 2, what is the biggest threat in the world to America? They said, Governor, you're being briefed by the CIA about all the different threats. What's the biggest threat to America? The answer was not Al-Qaeda or even China. The answer was isolationism. Yeah. The idea that somehow America ought to have its national sovereignty and protect it first, that is the biggest threat to the national security of the United States. That was his answer. So, all that stuff about a humble foreign policy was just a bunch of garbage for the rubes, and he had his fingers crossed when he said it in the first place.
I'm sure you're right. I think one thing that's really interesting in all this, and this is something that I've argued a few times over the past few years, is that it's important, I think, to see the Bush administration's military interventionism as the natural successor to Bill Clinton and Tony Blair's interventionism in the 90s. Because what you have today is you have lots of kind of left-leaning or liberal journalists who are critical of Bush's wars, particularly in Iraq. And I think it's important to remind people that, in fact, the worst things about Bush's military interventionism, he inherited directly from the humanitarians, as they call themselves, under Clinton and Blair. So, for example, let's just take two things. Two of the worst things, I think, about Bush's warmongering is, firstly, his kind of disregard for state sovereignty, where, state borders and state sovereignty doesn't matter. If the West is right, it can go wherever it likes and do whatever it wants. The second thing is his kind of super-moralized view of the world, where everything is good and evil, and he has this kind of pseudo-religious view of America as good and other forces around the world as evil. Both of those things come directly from Clinton and Blair and the humanitarians and the liberal hawks who cheer-led Western intervention in the 90s. It was Clinton and Blair who said that the old system of state sovereignty has to come to an end. We need an international community that can go around the world and fix everyone's problems. And it was also Clinton and Blair who first used that very simplistic moral language to discuss conflicts in Bosnia and Kosovo and Iraq and Sierra Leone as good and evil, black and white. And so I think we should always remind people that, yes, Bush is doing pretty shocking things and it's terrible, but let's look at where this comes from so that we can really understand its origins and criticize all the people who've been involved in allowing this to happen.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was the precedent set too, because in the first Gulf War, you had one sovereign state invading another, but in the 1990s under Clinton and Blair, it was civil wars that they decided they could go ahead and get involved in conflicts going on entirely within states and
That's
so forth.
Right.
And they didn't need the UN Security Council. Not that I think the UN Security Council has any authority to declare war against anybody, but they went ahead and went around it and used NATO instead when Russia and China vowed to veto.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's another striking thing. Lots of people will now say that the war in Iraq is illegal, and strictly speaking, it is. But they forget that lots of those people supported the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, which was also, strictly speaking, illegal. But I agree with you. I think it's a really important point about, we should not accept that the United Nations Security Council has the right to say that war can take place. So, when people say to me the problem with the war in Iraq is that it's illegal, I always say to them, well, would it have been okay if it was legal? If the UN Security Council had said, yes, go ahead, would that have made it okay? And in fact, I would argue that the only thing worse than an illegal war is a legal one, because a legal war would require even more Western states in agreement that Iraq or somewhere else ought to be bombed, even more Western powers lined up against it, all having voted for this conflict. So if anything, the idea of a legal war, one which has the support of the whole UN, is more terrifying than the illegal war we see at the moment.
Of course, the only real justified war, if any war could be justified, would be a defensive one. What you're talking about is the UN Security Council's supposed authority to sanction an aggressive war, to sanction the beginning of a war.
Yes, that's right. And you know, and also I think it's important to recognize that international law is something of a contradiction in terms. You know, law is something that grows fairly organically from a nation state and from the people who live in that state and from their needs and their desires. The idea of international law is by definition basically Western imperialism dressed up in legal language, which is this idea that there are standards that can be set by the UN or by Washington, and that anyone who doesn't live up to them can be attacked and bombed and have its sovereignty undermined.
Well, I sure wish we had more time, but we're all out of it. Everybody, BrendanO'Neill.net is the website. Brendan O'Neill is a journalist and the editor of Spiked Online. He's got a new book coming out soon called Bosnia to Beslan, How the West Spread Al-Qaeda, and his new article in the American Conservative Magazine, which you can read at BrendanO'Neill.net, is The Bosnian Connection, the civil war that inspired both liberal hawks and Islamist jihadis. Thanks very much for your time today, Brendan. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Well, folks, I had a lot more news to go through for you today, but I just ran all out of time, so you have to tune in tomorrow, 11 to 1 Texas time, for Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas.